You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
And greetings, my friends, patriots, lovers of democracy, truth, and justice, believers in peace, freedom, and the American way. Tom Hartman here with you, broadcasting live. Yesterday and today, we're broadcasting live from the Take Back the American Dream Conference here in Washington, D.C., put on by OurFuture.org. And some really remarkable things going on. Hang on just a second here. Every now and then my computer yells at me. A lot going on in the news. Yesterday, for the first time, the White House was asked to weigh in on what's going on with this whole American Dream thing. It's really interesting watching the movement evolve, watching the factions come out, watching, you know, it's like deja vu all over again. I saw this in the 60s and 70s. I'm seeing it again. Watching factions emerging that are saying, you know, oh, no, we're going to take a charge of this. No, we're going to take charge of this. No, those guys aren't enough. No, those guys are too much, you know, bloody, bloody, blah. But anyhow, they asked the Wall Street, they asked the president about it. And the president said, just, you know, actually, the president didn't say anything. The president's spokesman, Jay Carney, said, I haven't discussed it with him, but I'm sure he's aware of it because he follows the news. I would simply say that to the extent that people are frustrated with the economic situation, we understand. I think that they have to be very happy about this. Karen Nussbaum, great
Tom
to see
Hartman,
you.
Good to see you.
Thanks for joining us. Karen Nussbaum is with us. She's the founder and executive director of Working America. This is the group that the AFL-CIO has for people who don't have a job or do have a job, and it's not a union job, but they'd like to participate with the AFL-CIO, like to have some of the benefits of unionization. And you are also the author of the book Solutions for the New Workforce with John Sweeney and the former director of the AFL-CIO's Women Department Special Assistant to President, workingamerica.org, the website. Karen, tell us, first of all, here we are at this conference, your take on what's going on.
Oh, it's a very exciting conference. It's huge. There are people from all over the country. And it's an exciting time to come together. I think especially with the Occupy Wall Street and now the copycat demonstrations that are happening all over the place, capturing this, for many people, inchoate demand, which is basically for jobs and democracy. Folks out there know corporations run their politicians, run their economy, and run it all into the ground. And people are looking for a popular response to begin to turn this around.
Gandhi's famous quote, if I remember it right, I'm sure I'm paraphrasing one of several versions of it, but, you know, first they ignore you, then they fight you, then you win. Or there's another piece in there. But it's, you know, the first couple of weeks of this, you know, we were talking about it on this show. I don't think many others were. Certainly in the television they weren't. And then the women got gassed last weekend. And now I saw this segment for Maria Bartiromo's new show on CNN. And she went down and, like, basically interviewed some hippies and made fun of the whole thing. And so now we're in the corporate media's end of now they ridicule you. But the rest of us realize this is not something to be ridiculed. And I think that then they win, you know, it takes some years in most cases. But would you agree with that analysis, that we're in that arc, that this movement is becoming real?
Yes. And I think we're seeing it in other parts of the world as well. You know, when you see a million people in Madrid or in other capitals in Europe who essentially have the same demands for jobs and democracy and don't know who to make the demands of, don't know how they're going to win it, it's a public outcry here. It's starting very small, but I think as we begin to knit together the spontaneous response that's happening with institutional power from labor, from other organizations, I think what we're going to see finally is some restraints on a political system that really doesn't work for us at all.
Yeah, absolutely. We've seen the Tea Party, arguably an independent movement. I mean, we all know that there's a large astroturf element to it, but a lot of the people who showed up had no idea. They just wanted change. We've seen the Tea Party take over a large chunk of the Republican Party. Do you see this movement moving the Democratic Party? And to what extent might that be a good or bad thing? And, you know.
No, I don't. I'm not really concerned about the parties. Mm-hmm. And I don't think people out there are either. And I think as we start to really focus on how can individuals fight back against corporate power, corporate greed. People talk about it as corporate greed. They think our politicians are greedy.
Yeah.
That's the way people feel about our system, and I think connecting with that, taking people out of their isolation, giving them a sense that there is strength in numbers and that we can fight back, that's where we have to start. And if we start there, then the parties will follow.
Yeah, I'm absolutely with you. And right now, so yesterday Leo Girard was on here and said the United Steelworkers are now standing with the Occupy Wall Street movement. I believe the Rich Trumka, the AFL-CIO, has come out and said something very similar. For your organization, the Working America, workingamerica.org, what's your perspective on what's the organization's relationship to how are, you know, the movement, you know, what, all that kind of stuff? I'm just curious.
The concerns of the occupiers are the same as the concerns that we hear 20,000 times a week, literally, when we talk to members at the door. It's the same set of concerns about jobs. I can't find a job. My kid who went to college can't find a job. Those jobs don't have benefits. And that I have no voice in the political system. That's basically what we're hearing. Now, I don't think Working America members are going to be the very next people to go out and spend the next 3 weeks living in a park.
Mm-hmm.
They're generally people who have family responsibilities and are looking after their kids or trying to keep their jobs. But the coming together of the demands, I think, is what's the most important thing. And now we're trying to give everybody a way to express those concerns and exercise power in the way that makes most sense to them.
There has, and I think very wisely up to this point, the movement has not, the people in the movement have not expressed specific demands. There has not been a, here's what we're looking for, here's what we're up to. It's just, we know it doesn't work. And I know there are a lot of different solutions out there. I wrote a book called Rebooting the American Dream, 12 Steps. Others have, and we're hearing speakers all around here. I'm curious what Working America's prescription is to turn this country back into a country that works for the middle class rather than just the top 1%. We have a minute to go.
Here's where we're starting, specifically with the Occupy Wall Street and the rest, is the financial speculation tax. Why should these banks, why should these investors get to risk our money, ruin our economy, and not pay the smallest amount of tax on it? We want to start holding big business and Wall Street accountable for what they're doing to our economy, paying back in and have some tax.
So you're standing with the National Nurses United on that.
Yeah, I love their campaign, and I believe that demanding a speculation tax will restore health to the economy and put the...
Well, we had it here from World War I until 1964. We had it to fund the Spanish-American War. Europe has just basically voted to do this, the European Union. It's got the banksters flipped out, though. These guys who are, have developed this whole brand new industry of having machines connected to the Wall Street computers that flip a million trades a second.
Speculation tax is mainstream politics. It should be here, and it's a way to actually find the funds to invest in jobs in this country.
Yeah, I agree, and I think this is retail politics. This is on the grassroots stuff, and it makes sense to people. Why should these banksters who pay a maximum 15% income tax the way they do business, why should they be churning the stock market, skimming the money off, sticking it in their pockets, taking a $1 billion-a-year paycheck? And we get screwed. I mean, Karen Nussbaum, founder and executive director of Working America. Check out workingamerica.org. We'll be right back. Thank you, Karen.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
We'll be back with more guests from the Take Back America Conference and your calls at 866-987-THOM. Welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you live from Washington, D.C. from the Take Back America Conference. And with me is Robert Weisbaum, Weisman, the president of Public Citizen, the venerable organization started by Ralph Nader back in the day and now just doing extraordinary work. Robert, welcome.
It's good to be with you.
Great to have you here. What's going on with this conference? What's Public Citizen's role with the conference? And what are your thoughts on taking back the American Dream? How is Public Citizen participating in that?
Well, obviously, taking back the American Dream, that's a big agenda. I mean, one thing that we've been focusing on is the impact of the Citizens United decision in empowering corporations to push forward their dream and undermine the ability of regular people to influence policy in a whole variety of ways.
And for example?
Well, the decision is, you know better than anybody, empowers corporations to spend whatever they want to influence election outcomes. So the impact is direct on elections. It's going to be far worse, by the way, in the 2012 elections than we've seen in 2010. Karl Rove has announced he's going to have $250 million at hand to spend to influence elections.
2010 was like a rehearsal.
2010 was pretty bad, but going to be just a small thing compared to.
And then they practiced some more in Wisconsin. And it was pretty amazing, pretty ugly to see. What specifically, you know, there are a lot of policy prescriptions out there. You've got some people calling for a constitutional convention. I'm personally in favor of movetoamend.org, a very simple amendment to the Constitution that says basically corporations aren't people and money isn't speech. You know, take that, Supreme Court. I mean, we have to realize this is law made by the Supreme Court going back to 1815, the Dartmouth case, the 1886, the Santa Clara County case, the 70s, Buckley versus Vallejo, the 80s, First National Bank versus Boston, versus Bilotti, First National Bank of Boston, and now Citizens United. And it's been this evolution of a doctrine that has been created solely by the Supreme Court, and which causes me to question the premise of Marbury versus Madison, you know, judicial supremacy, judicial review, but that's a whole other conversation. What is Citizens United's position on how we should address this, either the successive power taken by the Supreme Court? Article 3, Section 2, as you know, says that the court shall operate under rules defined by Congress. I haven't seen those in a long time. And nowhere in it does it say the court can declare a law unconstitutional. And secondly, I guess I've thrown enough stuff out here. Go for it. Your turn to riff.
Yeah, well, I mean, I think there's a range of things we can do without a constitutional amendment, but this decision is so serious, and there's nothing that Congress can do to overturn it. As long as we live in a Citizens United world, we're going to be at a major, major disadvantage. So we're with you. We're on board for a constitutional amendment to overturn the decision. Exactly how that's drafted, we're happy to have the conversation. We're also happy for the conversation to wait. I think the big thing is, because people actually are with us, people get the idea that corporations aren't people. It's pretty obvious that corporations in a democracy should not be making the decisions.
Right.
The big challenge is to convince people that a constitutional amendment is feasible. And the only way to get there is by starting to build the movement. So we're all about that.
In the late 60s, early 70s, there was one song, and I'm old enough to remember this. You're not. There was one song. You're old enough to fight. You're old enough to die, but not for voting. Right? It was you tell me over and over and again, you know, the time of destruction, I think, was the name of the song. Anyhow, that song drove a movement for a constitutional convention, or not a convention, we don't want a convention, a constitutional amendment that literally changed the Constitution in 7 months. I mean, it took 7 months to pass the, I don't know what the number of it is, 28th, 29th, 29th Amendment, that gave 18-year-olds the right to vote.
Yes.
Less than a year. So it can be done. It just takes enough really PO'd, really activist, really awakened. And I'm very concerned about, you know, that there are some organizations out there that are doing this timidly. They're saying, well, maybe we should just amend the Constitution to say that Congress can regulate finances with regard to elections. And I want to go right to the root of this tree, corporate power, the idea that corporations are people and money is speech. Your thoughts, Robert?
I agree we got to go after corporate power centrally. I think that there are some technical things, and we should have, you know, some offline conversation about what the thing should be. But the idea of corporate person is a huge problem in Supreme Court jurisprudence and really in sort of the culture of policymaking. And I think one thing that this conference brings out related to what this issue is, things can happen suddenly. Social change can happen really suddenly, but you can't count on that. So you've got to do the long haul work and know that when your moment comes, you got to go. Is the Occupy Wall Street the thing that's going to set stuff off? We don't know yet. I mean, we can only hope. Right. We got to keep pushing forward.
You know, in biology, Stephen Jay Gould, his amendment to Darwin's theory of gradual evolution was punctuated equilibrium.
Yeah.
You know, that moments come, whether they're mass extinctions or other things, that cause a newly adapted organism to become the dominant organism when it was a very small minority. Gandhi echoed that sentiment in completely different language, as did Jesus, as did Martin Luther King.
Yeah.
It seems that this is one of those moments. With or without Occupy Wall Street, it seems that this is one of those moments.
We hope so. I mean, I think it's hard, a little bit hard within the culture to know when it's happening until it happens.
Yeah.
And all we can do is keep pushing forward. It's true. It happens all over nature, in the physical world too, right? So critical mass.
Yeah. This is why I'm so excited that Thomas Jefferson wrote into the Declaration of Independence the phrase, nature's God. You know, John Adams crossed it out and put in Christian God, and he crossed that back out and put nature's God. It's like, this is one of the laws of nature. Revolution happens. Change happens.
That's right.
And Public Citizen is doing their bit to make this happen at publiccitizen.org. And any specific initiatives people should know about very quickly? We have about 20 seconds.
Well, we're working hard on a constitutional amendment to overturn Citizens United. We're trying to push back against the Chamber of Commerce initiative to roll back all kinds of regulatory controls on corporations. And right now we're pushing hard to block these three trade agreements that the Bush and now Obama administrations are trying to push through: Panama, Colombia, and Korea.
Yeah.
These are corporate power trade agreements.
We had NAFTA, we had CAFTA, and now we got SHAFTA. Robert Weissman, the president of Public Citizen. Thank you, Robert.
Great to be with you, Tom.
Check out publiccitizen.org.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Call 866-987-THOM.
We'll be back with your calls and more from the Take Back America Conference, Take Back the American Dream Conference. Stick around. Welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you, broadcasting live from the Take Back America Conference here in Washington, D.C., and John Nichols, the Washington editor of The Nation, thenation.com, is sitting right next to me. And, John, it is great to see you.
It's very good. It's very good to see you in person. We have done this year probably
many times.
40, 50 times, usually by phone, talking about Wisconsin, talking about other struggles, and there is a great pleasure, you know, being...
Thanks.
You know, talk
and
about
we need to do it more.
Yeah.
222 years ago this week, something significant happened.
Yeah, this is my favorite story to tell, and it's just a little reminder. It's actually mainly for Ann Coulter, who's called the Occupy Wall Street folks a mob and all this stuff. Right. 222 years ago.
Arguably, in the language of 230 years ago,
they might be throwing tea into the harbor. Yeah. Well, but 222 years ago, this period right now, late September, early October, the Constitution of the United States was ratified. First, the amendments to it, the Bill of Rights. And the Bill of Rights, First Amendment, you have a right to assemble and petition for the redress of grievances, the most radical of all rights.
Right.
And it was ratified at number 26 Wall Street in New York City, precisely where kids are now exercising their right to assemble and petition for the redress of grievances. And it is my view that for the first time in 222 years, Wall Street is being used for a good purpose.
Wow. Wow. And my recollection is that that's where George Washington also stood when he was sworn into
that
office.
That federal building down there is where the Republic went from a dream to a reality.
Right.
Imperfectly, as
New York
was
our first capital.
You've written about the imperfections. But I just think it's so vital to come full circle there and to realize that these folks who are doing Occupy Wall Street are physically on the hallowed ground of the American Republic, the American experiment, American democracy, and they are using the first political right, that the founders gave to the people, that being the right to assemble and petition for the redress of grievances.
Right,
I think we ought never forget that, because there's so many people attacking them, condemning them, dismissing them, even some liberals who are very cautious about it. I just want to say, I think we're coming full circle, and it's a very exciting moment.
I was very disappointed to see this clip from Maria Bartiromo's new CNN show.
Really? I'm shocked that you were disappointed by a CNN show.
Yeah, in which she went down to Wall Street, and she just, you know, basically was interviewing hippies, and she finally got this one guy to say, well, I'll tell you what I'm upset about, the bailout. And she said, well, what if I told you that the bailout actually produced a $20 billion profit for the American taxpayer? And he goes, well, then, she says, would you still be upset? And he says, well, I guess not. And so, you know, it's like...
Well, A, it's a bogus argument because, of course, it doesn't recognize that in addition to the core bailout, they let loose $4 trillion of additional money put in the Federal Reserve for backing up corporations and banks, which is
actually
really what stalled out.
$13 trillion, according to Bernie Sanders.
Yeah, well, it is. And it's there are levels here, the $4 trillion being the initial and now the extension on it, giving loans even to the Bank of Libya.
Yeah.
And so the notion that we've been paid back is comic. It's part of what stalled our economy out is the structures that began with the bailout. But the other thing about it is this.
The Bush bailout, by the way.
Well, yes, indeed.
Let us make it very
Paul
clear.
Ryan bailout. He was the floor manager to get the conservatives on board. But here's the really important thing to remember about that. I think the vital thing. And that is that at a critical point when our economy was getting really stalled out, we gave bankers enough money so that they could stabilize themselves and then even throw some money back to the government. That's fine. But we did not do that for homeowners, for laid-off workers, for people in communities that have been suffering, you know, from plant closures, things of that nature.
Right.
So, I mean, even if what Maria Bartiromo or somebody or Aaron Burnett or whoever, what they're saying is right, even if what they're saying is right, the bottom line is this. We are in a society today that does that for bankers, but that does not do it for working people, for citizens. And that's something that should fundamentally change. I don't mind if some rich person got some money, paid it back. That's fine. What I care is that working people never got the chance in the first place.
Yeah. Did I mix up my hosts?
I think you did. I think it was Aaron Burnett.
Aaron Burnett.
I believe. And you know what?
I don't watch that much TV.
And you know what? Because I was as mad about it as you were when I saw it.
Okay. And you're better with names than I am.
No, I don't know.
I appreciate that. You have also, you're working on an article for The Nation.
Yeah.
And I know when you're in a work in progress, A, you so much want to talk about it, and B, you don't want to give away the whole thing.
Oh, I'll give it away. It's going to press tonight.
So great.
Yeah.
Well, then tell us about it.
Well, I've been out around the country and doing something that was fun. Katrina Vandenhoevel, our editor and publisher, was here the other day.
Yesterday.
And she said, you know, a while back, she said, you know, look, we got to really figure out about this primary Obama thing, this notion of running against Obama in the primaries. Why has it been so talked about but so little realized? What are the, you know, what's the mood? So I went out and I spent a lot of time talking to people. College students who are involved in sweatshop work, grassroots Democrats, labor folks, swing voters, going around. But everybody who liked Obama, the 2008 coalition. And I have to say, and you know this, Tom, from your show, first thing I heard was a stunning level of disappointment. It is something I wish I could have taken the president, who I've known, you know, not close, but I've been around for a long time. I wish he could have come along on this trip and met with some of these people and talked with some, just listened in, because it was so powerful.
You've met President Obama?
Oh, yeah.
I've never met him.
I've interviewed him, but back when he was in Illinois, covering local politics.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
In your neck of
the woods. Covered when he ran for the state Senate.
Sure.
And the new party endorsed him. He was backed by all liberal left coalition.
Yeah.
But I was so powerfully struck by how deeply disappointed people are. And yet their disappointment has not translated necessarily to a hatred of Obama or the sort of anti-LBJ anger. This anger...
Yeah, well, LBJ was aggressively, hey, LBJ, how many kids have you killed
right.
today?
Right. I mean, this isn't that. This is a sadness and a disappointment, but also a fascinating internal wrestling that people are going through. This question of, is this the right guy?
Right.
Literally, is he the right guy to throw into the 2012 race with the likes of a Mitt Romney or a Chris Christie? And I came away from it. It's one of those, as a journalist, it's one of those stories that I love the best. This story that does not come away with an easy, happy answer or everything wrapped up in a neat box, but with this fundamental reality that we probably have about two or three more weeks to decide whether Barack Obama is going to face any kind of serious primary challenge of any kind, what Ralph Nader's talking about, what other people, and also, you know, what that's all going to mean. And it's a very interesting thing because no president since World War II has been in Obama's situation. Very low poll numbers. A real lot of disenchantment with him in his base, and
arguably Reagan was.
Well, his base was still pretty solid.
Yeah.
But no president's been in this situation and not faced some kind of challenge. I don't think he will. I'm not sure that he will.
I have a theory about primaries.
Yeah.
And I may be totally wacky on this, but I think this is pretty solid. And if this has already occurred to you, cool. If it hasn't, feel free to...
I'll use it.
I use everything I hear.
Yeah.
But I would appreciate the credit for it, because I've thought about this long and hard. I believe that political institutions are not that different from biological institutions.
Mm-hmm.
I think that when Jefferson wrote Nature's God into the Declaration of Independence, he was very clear that democracy is part of the natural law.
It's an organic
reality. The natural order of things.
Yeah.
And I think that when a political organism recognizes that they're about to lose,
mm-hmm.
then out of that organism will come an attempt to change things. And that attempt to change things is either the people who are running it change direction, which I think we're seeing right now, and the candidate changes direction, or a primary challenge comes along.
Mm-hmm.
And I would submit to you that all of those primary challenges were of people on both parties over the last 100 years or longer, have been of candidates who probably would have lost anyway. The conventional wisdom is the exact opposite. It's that the primary challenge so weakens the candidate that they lose.
Tom, you're exactly right, but let me interrupt something. This is a fascinating thing. I'm working on this piece because you're wrong.
Okay.
About one thing. You're right about your theory and your historical arc, exactly right, as it always is. This one thing. Who were, from 1950 to now, except for Reagan, and I'm arguing since 1980 with the change in campaign finance laws and other things,
right.
There's not been a real primary challenge.
No.
The closest you got was Buchanan. But from 1950 to now, who, aside from Reagan, who were the presidents who were reelected with the biggest landslides?
Well, Nixon had a huge landslide.
And? Democrat?
Lyndon
Johnson, 64.
Yeah.
Okay, landslide wins. In 1964, Johnson and his surrogates faced a determined primary challenge from George Wallace, running on a segregationist ticket, who got more than 30% of the vote in Wisconsin and in Indiana, got more than 40% of the vote in Maryland. In 1972...
And Michigan went for Wallace.
Oh, he did very well.
Yeah.
But in 1972, Richard Nixon faced a challenge from a sitting Republican congressman on the right and a sitting Republican congressman on the left, who combined got more than 30% of the vote in New Hampshire. Primary challenges do not translate to necessary defeat.
That's my point.
Yeah, not at all.
They're a symptom of an organism that is struggling or in trouble.
Exactly.
And if the candidate changes his position, if the primary challenge causes
take in elements of what's going on. Exactly.
Right. If the organism adapts, it survives. If the organism doesn't adapt, it dies. And a certain amount of Darwinism, but I think it's more like Stephen Jay Gould's punctuated equilibrium.
I think this is one of those tipping points. And that's what this article and what I'm trying to do is to kind of open up this dialogue.
And so the question is, will Obama, become the populist that I think could win?
Mm-hmm.
And he's on the verge of, I think, doing some things that are really going to hurt his ability to do that.
These trade proposals are literally the worst thing you could do. And I don't know what's going to happen with him. I think he teeters on the brink, but I will tell you that people keep looking at the Republican fight. I think we're at an important side in the Democratic side as well, and defining what this party is going to be.
Is there anybody who would not a primary challenge?
Not anybody. No, I looked a lot at it. The logical person is Cornel West, because he's spoken up and also because he can deal with some of the challenges that people will have in taking on the first African-American president.
Well, that's a good point. John Nichols for The Nation.
Thank you so much. Thanks for everything you do.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Visit TomHartman.com for audio and video archives.
Back with your calls and more guests live from the Take Back the American Dream Conference here in Washington, D.C. We'll be right back. Now we're taking back the American Dream. It's the Take Back of the American Dream Conference that we're broadcasting live from here, the Tom Hartman Program. Welcome back. Let's pick up some phone calls here and get your thoughts on what's going on. Linda, Deerfield Beach, Florida. Hey, Linda, what's up?
Hi, Tom. I'm a little nervous. Thank you for everything that you're doing, though.
Thank you.
Addressing the postal service, because I am a postal worker.
Mm-hmm.
I've been a proud carrier for 13 years. And they are closing two major facilities, I think three, but one is in Oakland Park, Florida, and the other one is in Pembroke Pines. And the one has been an institution for 38 years there.
Uh-huh.
And laying off these workers is going to total about 800 workers.
So is it that they already have plans to do it, or they're already doing it?
They're already doing it. 250 people out of the one plan in Oakland Park Boulevard have already received their notice. And a tremendous amount of people don't know what kind of devastating effect this is going to have on individuals and the economy itself.
Because
these postal workers, they carry very, many, many valuable services that they that we just take for granted.
Well, and here's the thing that's most Americans don't get, and I think that there's two things. Number one, obviously, the reason why this is happening is because of this poison pill legislation President Bush and a Republican Congress. Somebody called into the show last week and said, "Well, it was a Democratic-controlled Congress." No, it wasn't. It was a Republican-controlled Congress passed that forces the Postal Service to take 75 years worth of retiree health benefit obligations and fund them over a 10-year period. Something that's never been done to any other government agency. No corporation in their right mind would do this. And it's how you put an organization out of business. And it's what the Republicans are doing. And now it's starting to break the back of the post office. And we need to call the Republicans out on this, number one. This is a crime. This is a poison pill, just like Medicare Part D, where you can't negotiate prescription drug prices, was a crime. It was an attempt to destroy Medicare. And now they're running around going, "Oh, Medicare's going down the tubes. Post office is going down the tubes. We need to privatize them." This is part of a long-term strategic plan by the Republicans that was put into place during the Bush administration, and both of these are, number one. But the other thing that I think most people don't get, that you know, Linda, because you are a postal professional, is that just ask yourself the question, if you're the consumer of mail, if you get anything in the mail, whether it's your bank statements or checks or personal correspondence, letter carriers are people who, by and large, because it's good pay, good benefits, pensions, a good union job, it's the kind of job where you get somebody in there and they work 20, 30, 40 years and then they retire. They're not going to have they're not going to be the kind of people who, if you instead have part-timers who are paid pizza delivery wages, might have the incentive to be opening your mail, stealing your mail, snooping in your mail. Problems that we have in some of these private postal law services and private post offices and things, around the country. Postal workers are professionals, and mail is a sacred trust. It's built into the Constitution, and we want professionals handling it. We don't want this thing privatized. Am I making sense, Pat? Or Linda?
No, we can do things that other people can't do. If there's an address that's not correct on that, we know their name. We know where they live. Even
right.
If the zip code's off, we can find that person. Believe it or not, it's kind of scary what we know.
Yeah. Well, and not only can you do. I mean, all the time. I get mail that's misaddressed to me constantly, and it gets to me.
Right. No other service can do that. And we also, the people trust us. They.
Oops. Yikes. I'm sorry, Linda. I have a different computer here today for the show, and didn't realize that just touching the screen would drop the caller. My apologies. Don in Portland, Oregon. Hey, Don, what's up?
Hey, Tom. I appreciate your knowledge of the Constitution, and I would like to know if you could please help me understand the filibuster and how a minority of Congress can manipulate and control a majority. And is the filibuster itself in the Constitution?
Yes and no. What the Constitution says, Article 1, I forget which section it is, but it's one of the first eight, says that Congress, each body of Congress can establish its own separate and unique rules for how it conducts its own business. So the House
sets...
So
when did this start, and why is it legal?
The rules of each of the House and the rules of the Senate started with the very, very first House and Senate, and they have... And they have to be rebooted every 2 years, with every new Congress.
Are we now in a situation where we are living where a minority can rule a majority?
Yes.
Just by, like a magician pulls a rabbit out of a hat.
Yeah, the Senate
with
has
a four-syllable word called filibuster.
Yeah, the Senate has always been considered the closer to the House of Lords and the House of Representatives, like the House of Commons. To use the British corollary, the House of Lords was hereditary, and our Senate was appointed by the states. It was not elected until we passed the 19th Amendment or the 20th Amendment. It's the one right around the giving the women the right to vote. That
I would like to see a change.
Provided, I think it's the 19th Amendment that provided for direct election of the senators, but the Senate around that time, around the Progressive Era, around the turn of the 20th century. Actually, the idea of a filibuster, the idea that a minority can withhold the majority, the Senate has always been the most conservative, and I don't mean that in the political sense. of the two bodies. It's always been the one that's least boisterous. It's always been the gentleman's club and now gentlewoman's club. It has always been the one that moves the most slowly. It's always been the one that feels its obligation to have inherent obstacles built into it. That's the history of the Senate. And the filibuster is part of the rules. Those rules can be changed every 2 years when a new House and a new Congress is established. Both the House and the Senate vote to either renew the rules, to modify their rules, or to start from scratch. And so if you want the rules, for example, the filibuster rule, if you want that rule changed, for example, Bernie Sanders has said he's all in favor of changing it. If you want that rule changed, then, you know, you have to be talking to your senators because they're the only ones who can do it. Got it, Don?
Frustration.
Yeah. No, I understand. I'm absolutely with you. The reason why the Democrats have been unwilling to blow up the filibuster is because they're afraid that after the next Congress, they're going to be in the minority and they're going to need the filibuster to stop Republicans. And it may well be the case. We'll be right back.
You're listening to Tom Hartman. You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
And welcome back to our program. Tom Hartman here with you live from the Take Back the American Dream Conference in Washington, D.C. Yesterday and today we're going to be here live. Then we'll be back in our regular studios in D.C. tomorrow. Taking your calls at 866-987-THOM. We've got a whole bunch of guests who are going to be dropping by as time goes on. Earlier in the day, Karen Nussbaum of Working America. We had Robert Weissman, the president of Public Citizen, and John Nichols dropped by. So, you know, people are wandering through and dropping in and saying hello. And in the meantime, picking up your calls. There's a lot of news in the news today. We'll get into that as we continue through the program. But first of all, got a couple of calls that have been around since the first hour of the show. Tony in Stafford, Virginia. Hey, Tony. Thanks for listening to Sirius. What's up?
I've been following this, your take, the Occupy Wall Street. And I was just wondering, are they really pushing to get out the vote type of message? Because a lot of times this ain't going to go anywhere unless the people vote.
Yeah. The Occupy Wall Street people, as far as I know, are totally apolitical. They're not associated with any political party. They're not pushing any political party. They're not registering people to vote. And I think that that's actually a good thing. I think that there are other organizations that do those things and, you know, other organizations that are political or are party affiliated. I think to the extent that the Occupy Wall Street group or any of the other Occupy groups, any of these other grassroots movements, stay independent, I think that that's a good thing. I think that what will come out of this, assuming that it survives and lasts like the Tea Party movement did, and you know, organizations get behind it that have some muscle and the ability to drive things into the press, like the unions now have, for example, the AFL-CIO, the United Steelworkers Union, is that some of those people will make that transition into the mainstream. But this is the organic way that politics should happen and historically have happened, frankly, in the United States, and that is from the grassroots up, from the ground up, from we the people up. So I honor the purity is probably the closest word I can come up with of the movement right now. I would never suggest that the Occupy Wall Street's movement or the various Occupy movements, student movements, elder movements, whatever, all around the country, should, I don't know about calling elders. I just got an email from somebody saying that I referenced Mike Price on the air. Mike was the head of the SDS when I was in it back in the 60s, that he recently died of cancer, and he said maybe we should call it Seniors for Democratic Society. I don't know, but I wouldn't want to see them get it political, frankly.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's what the Wall Street guys are counting on. They know what's driving the people today is they're mad at Wall Street.
Yeah.
But a year from now, people, the American people, got a short memory.
Yeah, and I think a year from now, people are still going to be unemployed. A year from now, the banksters are still going to be throwing people out of their houses. A year from now, they're going to still be robbing people. A year from now, the top 1% are still going to be holding on to all the wealth that they have. In fact, I've got some stats on that that are truly mind-boggling. Center for American Progress put these things together today. The top 1% owns 40% of the nation's wealth. The top 1% takes home 24% of the national income. The top 1% owns half of the country's stocks, bonds, and mutual funds. The top 1% have only 5% of the nation's personal debt. And the top 1% are taking more of the nation's income than at any time since the 1920s. And we know how well that worked out, right? 1929. So
you're missing one point, too.
What's that?
Is on your news that Eric Cantor said there's no way they're going to pass Obama's job bill.
No, and that's why I think that this movement is going to continue through the election, because the Republicans are playing the role of totally defending the top 1%, period, and not defending the 99% at all.
They don't want to give credit to Obama for nothing, and they want to make sure people are out of work. I keep telling my wife, they want this country almost into a depression.
They do. They absolutely do. That is the Republican game plan, is produce a depression so that people will blame the party in power right now, which is, the Senate and the White House is the Democrats. And it's a strategy that may actually succeed. I doubt it. I don't think so. I think a lot is going to depend on the positions that Obama takes between now and then. I hope he doesn't shoot himself in the foot with his trade deal. We'll see how that works out. But, Tony, I think you nailed it. Thanks a lot for the call, and thanks for listening. In New Haven, Connecticut, David. Hey, David, what's up?
Hey, Tom, good afternoon. I want to tell you thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
I want to thank you for a thought-provoking show. In doing so, I just wanted to mention you had some really interesting stats regarding, I guess, the Wall Street debacle and the...
top 1%.
What's going on with that. And I was going to ask you this, which is more of like a rhetorical question. In terms of trying to be the best that you can be and those who have earned who have made it to the richest 1%, what's wrong with trying to exercise everything that you can so as you can be the very best?
Nothing wrong with that. When you do it in a predatory fashion, though, when you game the system, when you hire, hundreds of thousands, when you spend literally tens or hundreds of millions of dollars on lobbyists to carve out loopholes in the tax code so that if you earn $1 billion a year as a Wall Street trader, you pay a maximum 15% income tax, then there's something wrong with it.
Well, I see your point. For example, President Silva, the president of Brazil, had mentioned, regarding the rich, where they, they have, economic gains and allows the poor to participate in, what they do. It's kind of like a joint relationship between, the individual who could, say, open up a Subway on the corner and the individual who gets hired by the gentleman who's running Subway. He might not be able to afford to pay the gentleman a living wage, $25, $28 an hour, but
then he shouldn't.
And the 12 wage.
Okay, $28 bucks an hour, is a living wage in some parts of the country. It's high for a living wage in other parts of the country. It's probably low in some parts. I don't know. But the point is that, David, we have to ask ourselves the question at the end of the day. And this is the question that the richest man in the world at his time, Sir James Goldsmith, asks in his book, The Trap, which I strongly recommend. It's out of print now, but you can find used copies easily. The richest man in the world, James Goldsmith, Sir James Goldsmith, he said, you have to ask the question, is the economy here to serve society, or is society here to serve the economy? And what Republicans are trying to sell us, what conservatives are trying to sell us, what Wall Street is trying to sell us, is that we are here to serve the economy. And that those people who control the economy get to skim all they want off the top, and they should pay very, very little in taxes or pay very, very little back to society. Whereas I'm personally of the opinion that we created the economy, the government creates the economy. It creates the currency for it. It creates the court system. It creates the laws of business, what you can and can't do. It creates a court system to enforce those. It creates jails to put people like Bernie Madoff in jail who break those laws. We create the economy, and therefore we get to set the rules of the economy, and the first rule should be, if you're going to participate in our economy, you're going to do it in a way that benefits society. Renee in Silver Spring, Maryland. Hey, Renee, what's up?
Hi, how are you doing?
Great. What's on your mind?
I got a problem about what's going on with the economy. It seems like we're getting deeper and deeper in debt. People are getting more poor. But I just want to understand, how is it that they're allowing, you know, this to go on, you know? Oh, Lord,
I'm sorry, you're fading out there, Renee. How is it that they're allowing this to go on what?
With Wall Street, they're allowing Wall Street to do what they're doing.
No, they've bought out our politicians. And frankly, most of our media depends on Wall Street, because Wall Street controls their stock, and their CEOs are paid based on the stock performance, and their senior executives, they're all getting stock options and stock bonuses. This is all stuff, by the way, that was brought to us by the Reagan Revolution. Prior to Reagan's presidency, it was illegal to compensate people, senior executives, with stock. But now that they do, you've got everybody trying to drive the stock prices up, everybody trying to play that they're Wall Street. Wall Street has gone from being 11% of our economy to 37% of our economy over the last 30 years. It's completely flipped. Used to be manufacturing was a third of our economy. Now it's under 10%. Used to be finance was around 10%. Now it's over a third. This is wrong. We need to change it.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
And we need to be able to pass laws, though the politicians don't have to be afraid of these people. The problem is the Supreme Court keeps knocking down those laws. We need to change the Supreme Court. Welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you. We're broadcasting live from the Take Back America Conference. And here in Washington, D.C., where there's a whole lot of people really actively and aggressively working on the whole concept of taking back the American dream, excuse me, not just America. They've adopted Van Jones's language, take back the American dream. And, you know, this to me is like about as grassroots and about as genuine a populist revolution as you can get. I think it's just absolutely great what is going on out in the streets, what's going on in Washington, D.C., what's going on in New York, and what's going on here. There's the absolute outside game, people who are just showing up, may not even be politically aware. In fact, Fox News has made a sport of, and now CNN as well, of going down to the Erin Burnett with her new show, going down to the Occupy Wall Street group and finding people who are politically unsophisticated, asking them simple questions, getting dumb answers, and then portraying the whole movement as stupid. That, in my opinion, that's a media crime. But beyond that, there's people actually. So on the one end of the spectrum, you've got people just saying, "We may not know all the details. We don't pretend to have the answers. We're not part of any political party, but we know we're mad as hell and things are not working in this country." So you've got that. And then on the other end, you've got the institutions, the political parties, the unions, things like that. And they're starting to wake up and say, hey, you know, these people have got something going, and they can be the parade that we can follow. And I frankly believe that we're going to see significant change coming out of this. What that change is going to be like, how it's going to work, who it's going to be, how it's going to be, I don't know. It's going to be real interesting to watch. Robert, Little Rock, Arkansas. Hey, Robert, thanks for watching us on Free Speech TV. What's up?
Tom, there's one very wealthy man in North Carolina that has funded at least three-quarters of the money that's gone to change the state legislature in North Carolina to Republican. 18 out of 22 seats are now held by Republicans, where that hadn't happened in a very long time.
Right.
And so what that Republican legislature has done is they've changed the election laws to where 500,000 of the voters in North Carolina are not going to have enough ID to vote.
Yeah, that's a half million. In fact, the best guess is that at least, because North Carolina is not the only law that's passed this, the best guess is that at least 5 million Americans, and there are some estimates as high as 34 million Americans, but probably of those 34 million Americans who have been disenfranchised so far by these laws that are being passed, that were hatched by ALEC, the Koch brothers-funded American Legislative Exchange Council, where corporations sit with Republican lawmakers and come up with laws to pass at the state level. Hatched by ALEC, passed by a series of state legislatures, that 34 million people are not going to be eligible to vote who thought they were eligible to vote. And of those, that typically about 5 million of those people would actually probably show up and discover that they no longer have the right to vote.
Right, they don't have the ID.
Yeah, right.
Yeah, okay.
Yeah, you're absolutely right, and it's a crime. I mean, I don't know how to describe it beyond that. It is a crime.
How come the Attorney General in North Carolina let that happen?
You'd have to ask the Attorney General. I
Okay.
You know, I don't know the answer. Or for that matter, why did the North Carolina Supreme Court not take that on? Why, you know, I know that there are going to be challenges to all these laws. I know that they're going to be challenged in the United States Supreme Court. The problem is all these challenges are going to happen after the 2012 election. And the whole point of these laws is to make it harder for Democrats, in particular President Obama, to get reelected, because the Republicans understand the Supreme Court is at stake. And that's, from their point of view, that's what this is all about. And that's why the big money people in the Republican Party, that's why, you know, Mitt Romney is getting millions and millions of dollars from Wall Street. They're his largest contributor. They don't care, frankly, even which party the president is, as long as they know that they're going to get their people in there. They're far more wary, however, of Democrats than of Republicans. And we'll see how this shakes out. We'll see how this shakes out. But we're in for a tough time. You know, progressives in general, Democrats in particular, and you know, it's going to be a tough time. Robert, thank you for the call. Frank in Cambridge. Hey, Frank, what's on your mind today?
I read an article in Sunday Boston Sunday Globe. It was a book review. My thesis is about the trickle down theory. Mm-hmm. Now, like so many of these, like all of these Republican arguments, they sort of make sense if you listen to just the argument, if you just listen at the surface level. But if you go down a little deeper, what the trickle-down theory, and I've heard this is, when I read the article, I was surprised, but then what happens is that people at the top who are making $10 million as CEOs, all of a sudden making $50 million, and they buy bigger houses, bigger yachts. The class below that sees that, And starts buying bigger houses and bigger yachts.
Well, no, actually, the trickle-down theory is that when they buy those bigger houses and bigger yachts, somebody has to build them, and that creates jobs. And that's the trickle-down theory.
The trickle-down theory is not really, if that were true, it would work in some sense. Yeah. But what I'm saying...
Right, it works in a small sense.
Yeah, but what I'm saying is what they mean by the trickle-down theory, underneath this argument that it creates a few jobs, is that the trickle-down theory is more like keeping up with the Joneses, as witnessed by the 2008 debacle with the housing. Yeah. People started buying $500,000 houses with no income and all of this because they wanted to live in a $500,000 house, I suppose, for as long as they could. Right. But what I think is, The main thrust is that if you start looking at these Republican arguments and start tearing them apart with reality, like I saw a man on C-SPAN, a professor from Wake Forest University who used to be from North Carolina, and he was up here, they filmed him at Harvard. Mm-hmm. His whole spiel was about the backbone of his argument was about Ayn Rand.
Yeah.
And he gave the whole spiel about... It was really Bonnie Frank's fault.
I know. These guys, they're lying through their teeth. Frank, we're out of time, but your point is well made. Thank you very much for calling and making it. We'll be right back from the convention.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Call 866-987-THOM.
Broadcasting live from the Take Back the American Dream Conference here in Washington, D.C. You can check out conference details at ourfuture.org. Welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you, broadcasting live from the Take Back the American Dream Conference here in Washington, D.C. And Isaiah Poole is with us. He is a journalist, and he's also the online communications director for the Campaign for America's Future, ourfuture.org, which is the organization that put this thing together.
Right.
Isaiah, great to have you with us.
Well, I am really happy to be here. I'm really happy to have you here with us.
Thank you. Tell us what... First of all, I'm curious why, you know, this conference has had a bunch of different names over the years. It was the Take Back America Conference. It was the Our Future Conference, I think.
It was the, went from, to the Take Back America Conference, and then when President Obama was elected president, before President Obama was elected president, we went with America's Future Now, because we thought we had, in fact, taken back, in a sense, a portion of America. But obviously, now we're in a stage where, in fact, we're going to have to go back and once again reclaim the ground that the American people should have in a democracy. And taking back the American dream was our way of capturing that.
And, you know, Van Jones, I mean, I wrote a book called Rebooting the American Dream that came out last year. Cool, they picked up my language, but I think it actually came from Van Jones's Rebuild the Dream, or Rebuild the American Dream.
Exactly. He had been working on that theme for quite some time.
Yeah.
He shared it with us very early on in the process, and that's why we were very ready to adopt it. The Campaign for America's Future has always had a mission of working on behalf of rebuilding the middle class and fighting for the working class people. So it was unnatural for us to embrace that language.
Yeah. And so what is the Campaign for America's Future in general, and where do you go from here?
Well, the Campaign for America's Future actually calls itself something of an action tank. And what we do, we think about the strategies that are needed and the facts that are needed in order for activists out in the field to actually win these battles.
Mm-hmm.
And one of the things that we've been successful in doing over the years is actually being a sort of an incubator for movements that then move out from our place and live their own lives. So, for example, the whole green energy alliances between environmentalists and labor were actually, a lot of that was born at the Campaign for America's Future.
That's great. That is absolutely great. And so beyond putting on the conference, you've got all these things going on. Tell me, what's going on at this conference that our listeners or our viewers who are not here need to know?
Well, there is a lot of there's a lot of energy out there. And one of the things that people are saying about the Occupy Wall Street, and I'm sure other hosts have talked about, there's no agenda for the Occupy Wall. There's no 10-point plan. Actually, there very much is. It just doesn't look like the things that we normally generate from Washington think tanks or that sort of thing. But there is this sense that America has gotten seriously off track, that democracy has gotten seriously off track. And what you're seeing in movements like Occupy Wall Street is this real strong sense that we've got to take back America for us, not the corporations, not the Koch brothers, but you and I and those of us who go out and make a living day after day. America belongs to all of us.
We the people.
Yeah, exactly. And so that is what we're trying to build. So at the Campaign for America's Future, our main focus is on the economic part of that. And how do we take that energy and channel it into specific things that get Americans back to work, that make sure that workers' rights are protected, and how we have a sort of an economic structure that enables people to get living wages, good health care, income security when they retire, those kinds of basic kitchen table issues.
That's great. That's great. Step by step. Would you like to take a couple calls with me?
Yes.
Let's interact with some of our listeners here. Scott in Asheville. Hang on just a second here. Scott in Asheville, North Carolina. Scott, you're on the air with me and Isaiah Poole. Brain fart for a minute there. Scott, what's up?
Hey, Tom, I just wanted to thank you and let you know that I respect you. I'm a new listener, and I've learned a whole lot from you. And just a quick comment, I think that you, NPR, PBS, Norman Goldman, are the minority of journalists out there that are actually teaching us things and talking about things in depth, where the multitude, the majority of everybody else is just...
Well, thank you, Scott. Don't mistake me for a journalist, though. I'm an opinionator. Did you have a question that Isaiah might take a whack at, or me, for that matter, both of us?
I was calling. I had just two really quick points. My only things that I get frustrated with, even for hosts like you and also Norman Goldman that I like, is I think part of the problem is we're constantly fighting. I'm an independent, so I'm not a Republican or a Democrat. But it's just like all we're doing is I feel like we're taking jabs, unnecessary jabs, and it creates a kind of us versus them mentality example of Norman Goldman refers to the Republicans as Republicans.
Yeah.
And then
Scott, I really can't on this program. You know, I haven't heard Norman's show in years, and it's just I don't have time. I know him, you know, but I have no idea what he's saying on the radio. So I, you know, it's really you know, unfair and frankly inappropriate for me to be having a conversation about some of the talk show's hosts. But Isaiah, to the question, you know, here's a guy who's an independent, which is, you know, just fine. In fact, this political movement, there's a debate that I'm seeing on the message boards and blogs and, you know, in the blogosphere about whether the movement should reach out to political parties and unions or should run from them and try to remain pure and independent. I'm curious your thoughts on that.
Well, I think about the Tea Party for a second. The Tea Party made a very distinct decision that they would not be run by the Democratic Party.
Or the Republican Party.
By the Republican Party.
Yeah.
They have a set of principles and values that they stand up for, and when Republicans line up, they get support. When Republicans don't line up, they get opposition. Frankly, what Van and Bob Borisage and what some of the, and Justin Rubin from Move On and some of the other people who are at this conference are doing is saying, well, we need to replicate that.
Yeah.
And frankly, guys like Richard Trumka, the AFL-CIO, just came from a press conference with Arlene Holt Baker of the AFL-CIO, who made the exact same point. Labor, which often was characterized as being quote unquote in the tank of the Democratic Party, is now saying we represent labor, we represent workers, we stand with anyone, Democrat or Republican, who stands with the workers, and we oppose anybody, Democrat or Republican, who opposes workers.
Right. And I think that to a large extent this is the result of, you know, 100 and some odd years, particularly the last 30 years, of the Supreme Court increasingly saying the big corporations and rich people can buy politics, and they've been buying Democrats just like they,
well,
you know, they bought all the Republicans,
right.
and they're buying a lot of the Democrats. And thank God we have a progressive caucus in the Democratic Party.
Absolutely.
You know, literally 100 years ago, right now, the Republican Party was controlled by its progressive caucus, or at least it was a major piece of it. That went away with Teddy Roosevelt. I mean, that's long gone. But anyhow, let's pick up another caller here. Let's see. Jeff in Murphy, North Carolina. Hey, Jeff, what's on your mind today?
Hi, how are you doing today?
Good.
I was just thinking you should have more charts, more visual aids. I was watching Stephen Colbert the other day,
yeah.
And he brought out some charts to show that George Bush was the most effective president to bring down unemployment by giving these tax cuts to the top 1% corporations.
Uh-huh.
When he took office, unemployment was 5.1%. And after all the tax cuts, he brought the unemployment rate all the way down to 9.4%.
There you go. Yeah, you're right. You know, for radio, it's kind of, it can be difficult, but you're good point. Thanks a lot, Jeff. Thanks for calling. You know, we got a minute left here. You want to comment on that? Just, you know, what's the last presidency in Isaiah?
Well, you know, those statistics are out there. It's plain for everybody to see. But the fact of the matter is that just to sort of adopt a, you know, need to get, you know, the sort of the getting beyond the blame game. But I think on the other hand,
hey, there is crimes were committed. People didn't go to jail. Reagan sent 1,600 banksters to jail with the S&L crisis.
You're absolutely.
I mean, Bush sent nobody to jail. He bailed them out.
That's exactly right. And in fact, after they bailed out, they're doing things now like putting $5 charges on debit cards now.
Right, which is mostly used by poor and lower middle class people.
Exactly. What we do, what I'm about to say is that we should absolutely be doing truth telling.
Yeah.
Absolutely. And making it very clear who's accountable for what.
Yeah.
And it's not, and that doesn't have to be tit for tat, blame game kind of stuff that we play inside the Beltway. But it's this honest to goodness truth telling that we've got to do to make it clear to the American people what's really going on here.
There you go. Isaiah Poole, the a journalist and the online communications director for the Campaign for America's Future, the website ourfuture.org, the folks who put this conference on. Isaiah, an honor to talk with you.
Thanks
so much for showing up.
Thank you.
Great. We'll be right back. Stick around. It's the Tom Hartman Program, live from the Take Back the American Dream Conference.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Visit TomHartman.com for audio and video archives.
We'll be back with more guests and your calls right after this. Stick around from the live from the Take Back the American Dream Conference in Washington, D.C.
It'll come true.
Move on? Did I hear move on in that song? Welcome back. Tom Hartman here live at the Take Back the American Dream Conference. Sitting next to me, I'm very pleased and honored to welcome Justin Ruman, the executive director of MoveOn.org. Hey, Justin.
Hi, Tom. Good to be here.
Great to have you with us.
Thank you.
Tell us about MoveOn.org. It's gone through a lot of changes over the years. What are you all up to right now?
Well, MoveOn is about 5 million people in every nook and cranny of the country, every congressional district, and from all walks of life. And right now, for the last year, we've really been focused on making the economy work for regular people, pushing back against these horrible Republican attacks on the middle class, and building this American Dream movement that we're all here talking about to bring the American Dream back within reach for the 99% of us who've been left behind.
The language of the Occupy Wall Street, we're the 99%, not the 1%. And you're participating in the conference. You're a collaborator with the Center for America.
Campaign for America.
For America's Future. Mm-hmm. Ourfuture.org.
Right.
How do you respond to the people over the years, particularly the last couple of years, who have said, and I'm sure you've seen this, you get this kind of feedback, that MoveOn.org went from being an insurgent organization to an establishment organization?
I think MoveOn, one of the things that I've always loved about MoveOn, and that predates me, so I can't take any credit for it, but that is that we are member-driven. Mm-hmm. We make all of our decisions based on what used to be 2 million and then 3 million and then 5 million members say is, should be our priorities and then where we should come down on the big issues that we're facing or the elections that we're facing. And mm-hmm. So I think that means we get screamed at from all sides plenty of the time, but that's because I think we have this beautiful group of kind of pragmatic idealists, Americans, teachers and nurses and students and small business people who are have kind of a dream of a country that they could be, or busy people but are looking for ways to get involved, and they're the ones who set our policy. So we fought the Iraq War. We were we kind of joined the mass effort and helped lead the mass effort to try to defeat George Bush in 2004. We carried helped carry the torch for the anti-war movement and then elect a Democratic Congress. Mm-hmm. We our members said, we need to endorse Barack Obama back when nobody thought he had a chance. But he had captured the imagination of our members. We jumped into that race.
So how do you listen to your members? Is there a mechanism by which if I'm a MoveOn.org member, I can make my voice heard, or that I can participate, or if there's a particular item on the table, whether it's prosecute the Bush war criminals or decriminalize pot or get us out of Iraq or Afghanistan or whatever it may be, as a member, how do I float that up to the point where MoveOn.org sends out one of your famous emails and says, "This is our issue, damn it. We're going to take this to the wall. By the way, send us $5 to help out."
I think there's a couple of ways. So we've tried to build a dozen channels that, listening to 5 million people is an imperfect art. And so we tried to build lots of different ways to do it. We have a tracking survey that goes out every week that asks people what they're thinking about.
All your members.
We don't ask every member every week, but we ask kind of, everybody gets asked once a year. Mm-hmm. And we just sort of rotate through the membership. What do you think, which issues do you think are most important? What are you thinking about? What do you think of how the president is doing, et cetera, et cetera? And then we have a different email that goes out every day to another subset of people just saying, tell us what you're thinking about today. And I get, and then we have another set, a whole cadre of volunteers that just summarize those and then kind of feed those to the staff every day. And then we also we have a whole network of councils. One of the people often think about MoveOn is like email and online, but actually over the last 7 years we've built a whole, you know, online isn't worth that much if there's not an offline real world component to action. And so we built a whole set of, we have, you know, about 150 local councils, all volunteer led, all run by volunteers that are working on issues in their own communities. And, you know, and then we get feedback through those, people join those, they raise great issues. And then we've actually built a whole new system we call signon.org, because, you know, MoveOn with a pretty small staff, we could never run issues, campaigns on all the issues people care about. So we built a system called signon.org where anybody can start a petition if you know, they get it out to enough folks and it is kind of, and there's enthusiasm about it, we will then send it to, and it's something that our members agree with, we'll then send it to the MoveOn members in that area who then, you know, will sign the petition, but then the way the system works is people can then organize those folks. Hmm. And we give people sort of tools and help trying to, you know, do what we do.
Sort of like what the White House is doing with this
initiative. I mean, it's similar, except that it's really, ours is focused on not just a petition, but the petition is just like, you know, MoveOn started with an online petition. It was sent out by a couple folks who were pissed off that our country was gripped by this ridiculous impeachment proceeding back in 1998, and they signed
it. I remember well.
You know, so they launched a whole organization off of that, and we basically built a tool that allowed people to do the same thing.
Just in the minute we have left, what are the issues that are front and center for MoveOn.org right at this moment?
Sure. I think right now we're focused on pushing for jobs, a real jobs plan.
How?
For good jobs. Sorry?
How?
We have a big week, Jobs Not Cuts, week of action next week, and then we've said November 17th is D-Day. Right on the eve of the super committee reporting back, we need everybody around the country to mobilize for Jobs Not Cuts and making the rich pay, and draw a line in the sand that we're not going to accept another deal that costs America jobs and devastates the middle class.
So how do people show up and participate?
You can go to MoveOn.org. You can sign up. Anybody who's on our list knows there will be no shortage of emails offering you opportunities to get involved.
Yeah.
And I thank you very much for, by the way, for doing such a great job of lifting up this movement and giving it the attention it deserves.
Well, I've been on your list for a lot of years.
No, I don't mean just MoveOn, but I mean that, you know, this American Dream stuff that's happening here. I know you've been one of the folks to consistently talk about it, and it's really important. So thank you.
Good, Justin. Great work you're doing.
Keep it up.
Thanks for dropping by.
Thanks.
We will be back with more from the Take Back the American Dream conference here in Washington, D.C. Live. Put on ourfuture.org if you want all the information on it. And, of course, check out check out the whole thing. Yeah, ourfuture.org. I got it.
You're listening to Tom Hartman. You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
And welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you, live from the Take Back the American Dream Conference in Washington, D.C. A bunch of interesting news. I'm just looking at Democratic Underground here. Anonymous, a message to the media. On October 10th, the New York Stock Exchange shall be erased from the Internet. I think that kind of speaks for itself. Norma Rae, dead at 68 after the struggle with her insurance company to get chemo. The police are having to pay $100,000 to Amy Goodman. God bless her. She, when we were doing our show live from the Republican National Convention in Minneapolis, Amy came into the building and sat down, and I think the first media she did was sitting down with us live on our radio, what was just then a radio show, talking about how her, you know, two of her producers had just been beaten up and arrested. And she had been rather roughed up herself. So this is just spectacular. So how unwealthy are we, or how wealthy? You know, what are the top five facts about the wealthiest 1% that you need to know? I think this is just a brilliant piece. Zed Jelani wrote it today in today's Center for American Progress's Think Progress blog. The top 1% of Americans own 40% of the nation's wealth. Let's keep in mind, the main meme, if it were, I realize that, you know, the media in general are doing the very best they can to marginalize the Occupy Wall Street movement. You know, I've seen on Fox News, I've seen on CNN, little packages, little pieces, snippets, interviews, whatnot. Oh, it's just a bunch of hippies, or oh, they're just having a good time, or hey, it's just, you know, unemployed people, they need something to do, you know, blah, blah, blah. No. Their main message that I can discern, and as we all know, there's not an actual official main message, but their main message seems to be, we are the other 99% of America. And I think it's a really, really, really important message. Richard Trumka just showed up, the president of the American, or the AFL-CIO. And, in fact, let me turn your microphone on here. Great to have you back with us.
Good to be back, Tom.
Thank you. Thank you. Yeah, you got to kind of eat that mic, get right on top of it. So tell the AFL-CIO has, to the best of my knowledge, come out in support of what's going on with the Occupy Wall Street movements and these other, how would you describe the movements around the country?
Well, I think it's a grassroots coming together. The people are angry. They're fed up. They see no action being taken to create jobs. They see a Wall Street that destroyed tremendous amount of wealth, trillions of dollars of wealth in the country, that are now back to business as usual. CEOs got a 23% raise last year, and we have 25 million people out of work. And they said enough's enough. And they started demanding that Wall Street pay their fair share. And I think the vast majority of the American people agree with that notion. Unfortunately, because they're trying to make a living, a lot of them can't show up at those protests and at rallies and things like that. But those that can are giving voice to what millions of Americans feel every single moment of every day.
Absolutely. So the AFL-CIO is an institution. It's been around for a long time. I know that there are people within the movement, shall we say, you know, reading the blogs and hearing, you know, who are saying, stay away from institutions. We don't want to be co-opted. On the other hand, or maybe we should jump into these institutions and try to radicalize them or whatever. I don't know. But what are your thoughts on that? You know.
Well, first of all, the AFL-CIO is an institution and a movement. You can argue.
Well said.
You could argue.
And a democratic, small d, democratic institution.
Absolutely. You can argue at times we've been too much institution and not enough movement, and I've argued that myself. So we're trying to create a more movement, more of a movement, and coming together. We're coming together with all the progressive voices in the country, because this fight isn't just about collective bargaining or taking away union rights. This is a fight to silence the voice of every progressive out there. They do voter ID laws. Those ID laws disenfranchise seniors. They disenfranchise Latinos. They disenfranchise African-American community. They go after students. They go after immigrants, trying to keep us quiet, keep us divided. But we're coming together now, and you're starting to see the outages of it. In Wisconsin, you saw people come together from the grassroots up to defend public employees. In Ohio, you see it. You're seeing it right now at Wall Street, because what you have there are people from all walks of life. You have union members. You have people that do small business. You have farmers. You have a little bit of everybody there. Students, particularly students that have the greatest energy. And in my opinion, it becomes infectious. I love them for it. You have everybody coming together to say enough's enough, that this country can do better. It can do better than having one out of every three Latino or African-American child live in poverty. It can do better than have 25 million people without a full-time job. It can do better to have people having their pensions ripped away. We're the richest nation on the face of the earth. It's priorities. And I think they're speaking those priorities of the vast American, the large majority of Americans.
It seems like almost every other generation, about every 30, 35 years in America, we basically have a fundamental social revolution. I mean, you could start from 1776 and then Andrew Jackson ripping down the banks in 1828, and then the Civil War, Abraham Lincoln, and then the emergence of the progressive movement in the late 19th century and leading to Teddy Roosevelt, and then the revolution of FDR, and then the 60s.
CIO in the 30s, where we brought non-skilled workers together for a better way of life.
Absolutely.
Collective bargaining built the middle class from the 40s on.
Yep.
You're absolutely right.
And it seems like we're at that moment right now.
I think you're absolutely right. I think people are saying enough is enough. It's time to have a different kind of America. They're trying to make us believe that we have to downscale the American dream. And we don't have to downscale the American dream. We want to upscale it, because it's a matter of priorities. And we have to change the priorities of the country.
one of the major messages that I'm getting out of corporate media is that it's a bunch of hippies hanging around having a good time. They're unemployed. They're just goofing off. They're young people. You can't take them seriously, blah, 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 blah. For those old of us not to remember the 60s and 70s, that was a period of time where the exact same messages put out by the establishment media and you know, Richard Nixon talking about his silent majority in support of him. And yet that movement produced, I mean, keep in mind, SDS was created in 64 with the Port Huron Statement. Had nothing to do with war. It was about cutting poverty in half and enfranchising African Americans. And that happened within a decade. I mean, Lyndon Johnson literally cut poverty in half with the Great Society. And we ended the war. So there was a lot of social change that came out of that youth movement then. Are you hopeful that we will see social change come out of this youth movement now?
Absolutely, I am. First of all, probably a lot of those, the media that you talked about, the establishment media that's talking about those hippies, were probably those hippies 25, 30 years ago.
Well, some of them. I think some of them are so young that they don't have the institutional memory. I'm seeing, you know, these talking heads on TV.
Probably true, but I'm extremely hopeful. When you see this kind of energy, when you see this cross-section of America coming together, then you got to be hopeful. And look, for them to try to dismiss this movement by saying this is just a group of hippies, well, those hippies are saying the same thing that every American out there that I know of, whether they're seniors, African-American, Latino, whether they work in an auto plant or a coal mine, or they teach, or they're a police officer, they're saying the same thing. Wall Street destroyed a tremendous amount of wealth. Corporate America has taken over this country, and it needs to come back to we the people.
Yeah, absolutely. And you know, we the people is from the bottom up. I mean, this is the thing that people don't realize about labor unions is that they are democracies. You were elected by your members. You didn't just come up and say, "Hey, I'm Richard Trump. I'm going to take over." No, it's this concept of democracy is just so important, so very important.
You bet,
Richard Trump. Thank you so much for being with us.
Appreciate it.
Always great talking with you and having you on our program.
Thanks.
AFL-CIO.org, of course,
right.
And WorkingAmerica.org. We had a conversation earlier. So, Richard, thank you.
Thank you.
We'll be back with more from the Take Back the American Dream Conference here in Washington, D.C. Tom Hartman here with you, 20 minutes past the hour.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
We'll be back with more of your calls, 866-987-THOM. Welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you. Tom in Waterloo, Iowa. Hey, Tom, what's on your mind today?
Hey, Tom, I got a couple quick observations for you.
Okay.
What we have right now is a war on what used to be our civic duty. It used to be our civic duty to get out and vote, and now, as you can see, they're doing everything they can to keep us from voting. It used to be our civic duty to go out and be informed. And as you and Bernie like to so point out, that they are fighting everything they possibly can when it comes to information.
Right.
And it also used to be our civic duty to help our friends and neighbors in times of disaster, but instead they're getting us to steal from the poor to give to the suffering. I mean, we're really, really gotten away from, you know, one of our most basic principles.
Yeah, we're stealing from the poor to give to the rich, you mean. Yes.
Yeah.
Yeah, and I would submit to you that it's not just a war on our civil duties, but that the whole concept of civil duties is a moral concept, that this country was founded on moral concepts, and that those moral concepts have been expressed in many different ways by different groups, different religions, different countries, different parties at different times, but they basically boil down to that. You know, that incredibly poignant moment in Michael Moore's movie Sicko, where he turned to the camera and he said words to the effect of, it's been a long time since I saw the movie, but I'm pretty sure I remember this pretty closely. He said, ultimately, we're going to have to answer the question, are we going to be a me society or a we society? And this country was founded as a we society. And we go through these periodic hiccups, these periodic spasms. We did during the Gilded Age in the 1880s. We did in the Roaring Twenties. And we did in the Reagan years in the 1980s, and we are again right now. where the me society folks, the Eric Cantors and John Boehners and David Kochs of the world, basically run the show and control things and message the thing. And then America wakes up and says, no, wait a minute. The moral thing is to feed the hungry. The moral thing is to clothe the naked. The moral thing is to house the homeless. The moral thing is to heal the sick. The moral thing is to not just visit those in prison, but to not be 5% of the world's population with 25% of the world's prisoners. The moral thing is not to have 34% of your nation's children living in poverty, your families under 30 living in poverty. That's not the moral thing. That's the insane thing, and that's what we've been doing. And we have to change it. Dave in Los Angeles. Hey, Dave, what's up?
Hi, Tom. I just wanted to mention, over the weekend, there was an interesting development with the Occupy Wall Street movement and the Tea Partiers at the TeaCon convention. Josh Silver wrote a piece about this in Huffington Post. They actually got together, several of them, and agreed that they have a common enemy in the corporatocracy in Wall Street.
Jeez, don't tell Dick Armey. He'll panic.
Well, this is exactly my point, and then you're seeing this when the unions are linking up. This is, you're starting to see these different groups who have been through media, et cetera, kept at odds with each other. In fact, you know, left-right, make it an issue. I call it a distraction of the masses.
I call it the sportsification of politics.
And it's
turn them into teams.
It's keep us fighting amongst the peasants fighting amongst each other. Yeah. I'll never forget a caller. So several years ago on your call, on your show, a very old gentleman called in and said that he remembered the Depression. And one thing that shocked him is he said, during the Depression, the people knew who the enemy was. They knew it was the banks that ripped them off.
Right.
And it's one thing that it seems to have been great effort has been put into to keep the people from realizing that this time around.
Yes. Yes, absolutely. And this, as I thank you very, very much. So very well said, Dave. And as I keep pointing out, Ronald Reagan prosecuted 1,600 banksters, sent 1,000 of them to jail when the S&L crisis happened in 86 as a consequence of his having deregulated the S&Ls in 82. We deregulated the banksters in 2001. They crashed in 2008. Did George Bush put any of them in jail? No, he bailed them out. And it's got a lot of people upset, and it's got a lot of Tea Partiers upset. The fact that, you know, it's unfortunate, but most Tea Partiers think that the bailout was Obama's, not Bush's. But it was Bush's bailout. And now you're absolutely right. And this is what I've been saying since day one of the Tea Party movement, is that most of the people, you know, senior leadership, yes, of course, it's Dick Armey, it's David Koch, it is the plutocrats and the aristocrats of America. But the average person who's showing up for a Tea Party event or for a Glenn Beck event or whatever, they just know something's wrong. They don't know what's wrong, but they know that the big corporations and the banks have something to do with it. Randy in Seattle. Hey, Randy, what's up?
Hey, Tom. I don't think you're quite outraged enough about voter suppression, because there's something you haven't heard.
Okay.
You're a soldier in Kandahar. You're expecting your ballot to come in the mail, right?
Yeah.
But you didn't vote in 2010, so Colorado's not going to send you your ballot. You'll find this out on Election Day, and your ballot's not there.
We mentioned this on the air day before yesterday, last Friday, rather. Yes, you're right. This is the Secretary of State's decision, was it not?
That's right. A guy named Gessler, and he's suing over it because some of the county clerks are objecting. And, I really think this could be an emblematic, it could be a symbol. Even the troops now are getting, pooped on by the GOP.
Yeah. That's
it.
And thank you for keeping your language clean enough for radio, but... You're absolutely right, Randy. And you know, Republicans are, you know, they're very, very happy to use the troops as props. You know, George W. Bush loved using the troops as props. Frankly, every politician seems to love using the troops as props. But when you get right down to it, when you look at the Republican plan to cut down on the electorate, to do the Paul Weyrich thing, you know, of saying, you know, where the smaller the number of voters, the greater the likelihood that Republicans will be elected. That when you see that being played out, whether it's in these voter suppression laws, these voter ID laws, or in things like in Colorado with the Secretary of State saying, now we're not going to send out ballots to people who didn't vote in 2010, if they happen to be in Iraq or Afghanistan or whatever, it is so, so wrong. Randy, you're right. But I am You're not right that I'm not outraged enough about it. I am seriously PO'd about this. We will be back with more.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Call 866-987-THOM.
Tom Hartman live from the Take Back the American Dream Conference here in Washington, D.C. Take back the American dream. That's what it's all about here in Washington, D.C. today, and a fine thing it is. Karen in Abbeville, South Carolina. Hey, Karen, what's on your mind today?
Hey, Tom, this is an honor. Well, I like the American dream. We all have that, and we need to become a team. And you know, everybody likes teams, baseball, basketball, everything. And but team... The American dream of becoming a team, TEAM, the Ethical American Movement. The ethics are gone in this country.
You've invented an acronym, Karen.
Yes. The better you are at hypocrisy, the longer you'll be in D.C., you know? Mm. And I think a lot of the people, politicians, have a severe medical problem. It's like a drug addiction to money, and that's all that matters to them, and we need ethics back in this country.
Yeah, I'm with you. Karen, thank you very much. Very well said, and much appreciated. Brian in Asheville, North Carolina. Hey, Brian, what's up?
Hi, Tom. I'm calling today to talk to you about your question last week, is this a revolutionary moment, and how that applies to Occupy Wall Street. As far as I can see, this movement was started by Adbusters publication. Besides their slogans, "We are the 99%, and what is our one demand?" one of their slogans for Occupy Wall Street is, "This movement will not be privatized." Mm-hmm. I'm wondering how the Occupy movement will stay unified when the majority, as far as I can see, are Ron Paul libertarians and progressives, whose economic views are on opposite sides of the economic spectrum. I say this is a revolutionary moment. Obama was elected on change, and the right rebranded themselves as the Tea Party to try to capitalize on the atmosphere of revolution.
Yeah, I think you're absolutely right. And I think that this nation has been pregnant with revolution for a decade. And we saw the first cracks of that in 2002 when more than a million people showed up in the streets of America, more than ever in the history of this country, more than during the Vietnam movement, more than, you know, the Bonus Army, more than anything. To protest the possibility that George W. Bush would commence a war in Iraq. And he did anyway. And that was the first sign that we were in a revolutionary moment. Then, you know, there's been a series of them. I'd say the second one was the election of 2008 when Barack Obama was elected on revolutionary language, change. Change is the fundamental core of a revolution. It's the antithesis of the conservative movement, which is anti-change, which is stasis, which is status quo. And frankly, I think that the Tea Party at the grassroots, I think we have to make that differentiation between the people who show up for Tea Party events who are not particularly sophisticated and frankly, the people who show up, some of the people who show up, you know, in the Liberty Square in New York City who are not particularly sophisticated, the ones that Fox News and CNN search out so that they can interview them and get kind of dumb sounding answers to questions. Their heart is in the right place, and they understand that something's wrong, and they are part of that revolutionary moment. And frankly, I think that there's far more in common between the Tea Party people, grassroots people, and the Occupy Wall Street people than there is separating them.
They are calling for change to the whole economic system, and
yep,
and you know. Ron Paul wants a complete, you know, free market, change the currency to a gold standard,
yeah,
and everything should be privatized. And then the progressives want, you know, the SEC to work and, you know, Consumer Financial Protection Bureau.
Right.
And, you know,
progressives want regulated capitalism that we have demonstrated in the past works here in the United States and that the Northern European countries have demonstrated for, you know, half a century works just fine. Thank you very much. What Ron Paul wants is to return to basically Victorian-era England economics. In the middle of that, though, Ron Paul also wants to get out of the war, and he also wants to stop the insane drug war and the war against prostitution. And those are things that I think, you know, there's a general consensus for. So he's viewed as a revolutionary, even though economically he's a counter-revolutionary. But good point, Brian. Thank you. Thank you for calling and making it. Well said. Andy in Kansas City, Missouri. Hey, Andy, what's up?
Hi, Tom. Couple of things. I've been unemployed for 2.5 years as a professional, and I'm getting pretty sick and tired of applying for positions and not being able to land them because of my age. So I happened to call my representative, who is Congressman Sam Graves, and I asked him if he was going to vote for the jobs bill.
Mm-hmm.
And they told me that he was not. The next thing I
said... Is he a Democrat or a Republican?
Oh, he's definitely a Republican, okay. Hardcore.
Yeah.
I then asked him if he had signed the Grover Norquist pledge not to raise taxes.
Mm-hmm.
And they said that they didn't know for sure, but that he was afraid of the deficit. Well, I have news for Mr. Graves. I'm going to be down at Occupy Kansas City, which is going to be held on the 9th.
Mm-hmm.
And there's going to be at least 600 people there, maybe more.
Right.
I am tired of things the way they are. I want change, and I want it now.
I'm with you.
Okay. All right. Thanks, Tom.
Yeah, you're sounding like the Doors. speaking of revolutionaries and people who understand revolutionary moments, probably more than anybody, better than anybody I know, Paul Loeb is with us, the author of Soul of a Citizen and so many other brilliant books. And, Paul, what's the website you'd send people to right now for more information about you and your writing?
Soulofacitizen.org.
Soulofacitizen.org. Okay, yes. Let's get you up on that mic.
Soulofacitizen.org. That's
okay.
Right. That's right.
And the citizen?
A citizen.
That's okay,
right.
Great. Paul, you've written about this. You've spoken on probably half the college campuses in America over the last decade on these kinds of issues, this kind of change. What's your assessment of what's going on right now?
I mean, I think it's a very confusing time for a lot of people because the ground is just falling out from under them, sometimes literally. I mean, I was just in Alabama and saw the swath of the tornado in the climate change field. In Vermont, saw the swath of the hurricane climate change field. So sometimes it's literally, sometimes it's economically. And it makes for a kind of culture of fear where I think people are susceptible to manipulation, and they're all susceptible to just feeling the kind of, it's out of control, there's nothing I can do. And I would argue that our task is really to reach out. And it's interesting, if we look at the last couple of months, I think there's been a kind of upsurge, very heartening, of grassroots, particularly direct action. I mean, Wall Street, you know, various deoccupying counterparts around the country. What I think we need to do now to be able to extend and build on that is obviously more of the same, but also to really figure out how to actually be talking to people who do not necessarily consider themselves part of the movements that we're coming out of, but are certainly receptive potentially to their arguments. And I mean, it's interesting because, you know, in 08 we saw that with the vehicle of the Obama campaign, where you did have people knocking on doors and making phone calls and doing all those kinds of things.
Dancing their hearts out,
yeah, absolutely. And then at the same time, we saw that essentially kind of demobilized and shelved when Obama took office, partly by some, you know, I would argue, pretty bad decisions by the Obama folks, but partly as so many of us unfortunately sort of thought we could all do it with a click of a mouse while the Tea Party was organizing face-to-face.
Right.
And what we need to do really, you know, again, is that simultaneous sense, this is what I underscore in Soul of a Citizen, is you have to draw the issues to attention, but you also have to explain them, which some things like the direct actions do, but you also have to be able to explain them in a way that takes more than a sort of flicker of an image across a TV screen. It takes a conversation. It takes a dialogue. And we have to figure out ways. And again, we've done that before. Maybe we have to be able to do it more directly in a way that pushes our issues to the forefront, you know, even does build, you know, builds for 2012, but says this is much larger than 2012. Of course you have to show up, look what happened in 2010 when we didn't. Of course you have to understand the even sometimes marginal differences between candidates. There's no room for purism, but you also have to connect yourself to your fellow citizens, because we're going to have to keep pushing this vision. We've certainly learned over the last few years, no matter who's in office, no matter who we elect.
And you just said there's no room. There's no room for purism, and
yeah.
I'm hearing people's ears perking up all over the country, going, "Wait a minute! Martin Luther King did not compromise. Rosa Parks did not compromise. Mahatma Gandhi did not compromise."
Well, I don't think of them as purists. I think of them as people who put forth a radical prophetical vision of justice and kept on doing that. And we definitely need to do that. The purism comes into, say, an election comes and you have this choice of whether to participate or not. And if you don't participate, you're going to get a Walker, a Kasich, a Scott, or whoever. And that's practicality. Mm-hmm. That's being anchored. But the prophetic voice means you don't stop and be silent after the election. I mean, you look at the relation of the civil rights movement to Johnson. Personally, he's sympathetic. Practically, he spends a lot of his time putting the brakes on it, and people push and push and push, and then he does the right thing, which probably Barry Goldwater would not have done, political capital on passing the Voting Rights and Civil Rights Act bill. So it took a combination of that practicality and being able to keep putting forth that vision.
Yeah, Barry Goldwater definitely wouldn't have done that.
No, he would not have.
The civil rights movement had been infiltrated by communists.
Right, and he was
not a racist, actually.
No.
He integrated his store back.
Right,
before
but he sort of said, you know, we have no right to tell a store or a public facility or whatever that they should integrate. So I think part of what happened is the demoralization that's occurred, that I think we're beginning to climb out of in the last couple of years, is people detached from actually having these real-world conversations. And then they sort of sit back and, well, it's all spiraling downward. And I'm not putting a pretty gloss on some pretty ugly things. They're there. But we have to be able to be the ones to move the vision forward and keep doing it.
Amen. And keep up with it. Paul Loeb, soulofacitizen.org.
My pleasure, as always.
Thank you, Paul.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Visit TomHartman.com for audio and video archives.
We'll be back with more from the Take Back the American Dream Conference here in Washington, D.C. in just a moment. You tell him, Leonard Cohen, a great message for Americans, for citizens of the United States, from a Canadian. I find irony in that. I think it's wonderful. Mary Kay Henry is with us. She is the president of the Service Employees International Union, what we often refer to as SEIU, the website SEIU.org. And Mary Kay, welcome to the program. Welcome back to our program.
Glad to be here, Tom. Thanks.
Great to have you with us. You have a good jobs now. Everyone pay their fair share. No more cuts. Do I have
that's
this verbatim?
Chance. That's my chance.
That's your mantra. Okay.
Yeah.
So break it down, and how do we do it?
Well, you and I both know that there is $4 trillion off the table because of the Bush tax cuts, and there's another $40 billion because of oil and gas subsidies, corporate jet loopholes. And if we could close the loopholes and let the tax cuts expire, we could have a full employment economy. And
yes,
there's plenty of work that needs doing in our country. We think roads and bridges should get rebuilt. We think classrooms should get modernized so that our kids can compete in a global economy. So we've been led to believe as a people that it's not possible for us to get back to work, that we have to suffer through this terrible time, and it's not so. We think that everybody needs to pay their fair share and get the economy going again by getting America back to work.
Okay, so I absolutely agree with you, and you and I both know that well over 80% of Americans absolutely agree in frankly those terms. I mean, about
when's the government going to catch up with the majority?
Well, that's the problem. Is, you know, the Supreme Court has made our government a wholly owned subsidiary of corporate America to a substantial extent, not to an entire extent. We've got a very active progressive caucus. We've got some very, very good Democrats out there, but nonetheless, there's this battle right now over President Obama's jobs bill. The House of Representatives, the Republicans in the House of Representatives, are just going to stop it cold until the election.
Right.
Period. At the same time, in the Senate, you've got oil state senators who are saying, we don't want to close the oil loophole. You've got Wall Street senators saying, we don't want to tax Wall Street. And it looks like Harry Reid can't pull together a 50-vote majority for the job bill in the Senate, which the Republicans are pointing at. And they're going to try and make that the main story between now and 2012. The president can't even get his own party behind his own bill, whereas it wouldn't matter if he did or he didn't. It wouldn't pass the House because the Republicans would stop it. So here we are with this insane gridlock, much of it brought to us courtesy of the Supreme Court. But however we got here, how do we message through this? How do we communicate this to the American people in a way that doesn't caught that captures this energy of the moment, but doesn't lead to cynicism, that
right.
doesn't lead to the walking away from it that I think frankly we saw after Nixon resigned.
Right. Well, we think the best way to message through it is action, and that we need to get into the streets and stay in the streets through 2012 and beyond. And we have to accept that the law is not going to pass this fall. We, I think, need to hold Eric Cantor, who just told us this morning there's no way the American Jobs Act is ever going to get voted on in the House of Representatives. I think we need to figure out a way to hold Republicans accountable and make them vote against jobs in this country.
Right.
And then we need to keep the pressure on, I think, and keep building the momentum to November 2012 so that it can be crystal clear that people are voting for everybody paying their fair share, no more cuts to the common good in this country, and that we can get America back to work.
You know, you just said the common good. And this is one of the concepts that, frankly, I don't think is even taught in civics classes anymore.
Right.
I mean, you know,
it's at risk.
Yeah, in some part because of No Child Left Behind, the focus on science and math. But you know, the commons is the purpose of government is to protect and keep the commons, the air we breathe, the water, the national forest, our roads, our government is the most important part of the commons. How do we educate a generation that so doesn't understand that they would follow Ron Paul, who says, you know, basically let's privatize all of the commons.
Right.
I mean, literally, Ron Paul suggesting let's sell off the government buildings and lease them back.
Right.
Let some private landowner make a profit on them. How do you reach? I mean, it's amazing to me the number of 20-somethings and 30-somethings who have bought into this because they clearly just didn't understand the history of this government.
Right.
What do we do?
What we've been doing in our union is political economic education that's called Who Broke the Economy and What We Can Do to Fix It. And so I think we need to return to some basic education of each other and development of leaders because we've found that as our members get the light bulbs turned on and understand that it's not government and too much spending that's the problem. The problem is how unfair our tax system has become and the amount of wealth that is being concentrated in the top 1%.
Right. And SEIU is out there at the front of that. I mean, you're doing a great job with it. In the minute we have left, first of all, SEIU's official thoughts on what's going on in New York, Occupy Wall Street?
We're incredibly supportive of any group of people that's willing to get up off their couch and into the street and call the question on the future of our country. So we are incredibly supportive of what started as a student movement, just like we got behind the students in Wisconsin. We want to get behind the students on Wall Street and in L.A. and all the places that it's spreading.
That's marvelous. And SEIU, do you official participation or actions?
Well, our two locals in New York have been officially participating in Wall Street, and we're now having a national conversation with our leaders about how to add more support as it grows.
Yeah, because unions are democracies, so you have to do it democratically.
Talk it
through, and get together with the members.
And we'll be marching together with everybody here at the Take Back America conference on good jobs now, no more cuts on Congress.
That's marvelous. That's great. I'm not hearing the music that I thought would be coming, but oh, there it is. I thought the show should be. Mary Kay Henry, thank you so much for being with us, Mary Kay.
Good to be with you, Tom.
SEIU.org, of course, the website. It's great to have you.
Thank you.
Keep up the great work.
Thank you to all of us.
Yeah, indeed. We'll be back tomorrow, back from our regular studios. Don't forget, democracy begins when you show up, when you get active tag. You're it. We'll see you tomorrow.
You've been listening to Tom Hartman. For audio and video archives, go to tomhartman.com.